Support for the Capital Connection comes from
United University Professions, representing 37,000 academic and professional employees at SUNY campuses and teaching hospitals across New York State. Frederick E. Cole, President, UUPinfo.org. And New York State United Teachers, representing professionals in education and healthcare, online at nysut.org.
It's the Capital Connection. Hi, I'm Alan Chartok. Joining us this week is John King, the 15th Chancellor of the State University of New York, the largest comprehensive system of public higher education in the United States. Prior to his appointment as Chancellor, King served as President of the Education Trust, a national civil rights nonprofit which seeks to identify and close opportunity and achievement gaps for students from preschool through college. Chancellor King also served in President Barack Obama's cabinet as the 10th Secretary of Education. Before his appointment as Secretary of Education, Chancellor King fulfilled the duty of Deputy Secretary of Education. And before his service in Washington, D.C., King was New York State's first African-American and first Puerto Rican Education Commissioner. Welcome back to the Capital Connection, Chancellor King.
Thanks so much. It's good to see you.
I'm sure I've mentioned in the past that when I was a very young man, I was named from the west side of Manhattan, Puerto Rican ambassador from the west side, went to Puerto Rico. So please share your reaction to Governor Hochul's State of the State address. What's your plan going forward to help SUNY?
Sure. Well, let me first say that her speech, I think, was a great statement of her commitment to government being on the side of everyday New Yorkers and helping improve the quality of life in New York. Her focus on housing and climate action, hugely important. And certainly her focus on mental health is something that we're seeing across our SUNY campuses, students struggling with mental health issues. That was really exacerbated by COVID. So it's good to hear her talking about the need to invest in mental health. On SUNY, you know, she in her policy book made some important commitments to build on what she talked about in last year's State of the State, making SUNY the best public higher education system in the country. She talked about investing in our research centers, creating an innovative endowment fund that will help drive public dollars and philanthropic dollars towards research at Stony Brook University at Buffalo, University at Albany, and Binghamton. She talked about investing in labs, which will help us to lead the way in science and technology. She talked about the need to drive innovation across our campuses to help students not just start college, but finish college. She talked about the need to invest in capital for our campuses. So there's a lot in there that we think is very promising for the future of SUNY, and we're excited to work with her. She also talked about making sure that there's a reliable revenue stream for all the institutions so that they know that they will have the resources to provide an excellent quality education for students.
As you probably know, I was a long-term SUNY professor. Loved being there at New Paltz and then at Albany. Does the faculty appreciate what they have?
I think they do, and I think they also realize that we need more investment. It's clear that, you know, if you look at our buildings across our campuses, some of them have aged, and we need to take steps to renovate them. If you look at our research that's happening across SUNY, there's great things that we're doing, engineering at UB, the battery center at Binghamton, nanotech here in Albany. But we aren't at the top of the nation in terms of public higher education research. We need to recruit more world-class faculty. We need to make it possible for folks to have grad students. We need to make it possible for folks to have great labs. So there's work that we need to do, and I think faculty realize that.
And is that all about M-O-N-E-Y?
Yes, in part. I also think it's figuring out ways to make our systems work better together. You know, a lot of students start out at community college who ultimately want to get to a four-year institution. We have to do more to make it easier for them to make that transition. We have to do more to let students all across New York know about the great value proposition at SUNY. I mean, you know this as a former faculty member. We are providing at SUNY incredibly affordable, very high-quality education, and SUNY should be mentioned in the same breath as UC Berkeley or University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. We should have that kind of national reputation. Some of our campuses are very well known, but others less so. So we have work to do to make sure all New Yorkers see that there's a place for them at SUNY.
Well, you know, one of the things that I'm so interested in as a former SUNY professor was the fact that not everybody understood that, for example, when I was at New Paltz, I love New Paltz. But I don't know that these colleges have always had the absolute reputations that they deserve.
I think that's exactly right. And one of the things we're working on is trying to get that message out to high school students, but also to working adults who might need additional skills in order to advance in their careers. We've seen a big uptick in applications already this year. Yeah, and I think that's an indicator that some of our strategies to more broadly publicize the great opportunities at SUNY are working.
And what are those strategies besides your being here, which is immensely important?
Well, we are working with school districts to make sure that we get information out to every student that there's a place for them at their local community college. We want to make sure that students get an individualized letter that says there is a place for you so that students, particularly first-generation students who may not realize that
do you sign every one of those letters?
That's the goal. That's the goal. That's the plan. We also want to make it possible when students are applying for them to apply to multiple schools. We did actually a fee waiver, an application fee waiver in the fall, and gave folks the opportunity to apply to multiple schools. We also want to make it possible for students who don't get into their first choice to get a letter that says, you didn't get into your first choice, but here's another campus within the SUNY system that provides a program that is similar to your interests that you might want to look at. So that a student who, you know, applies to Albany but doesn't get in would get that letter that says, here's an opportunity for you at SUNY Fredonia, or here's an opportunity for you at SUNY Plattsburgh in a program of study that matches your interests.
Yeah. You know, one of the things I've always been very interested in is that we have a wonderful community college system. And yet, it seems almost deprecated in that we don't talk about it enough. I want to talk about that a little bit.
Absolutely. Look, community colleges, I believe, are vital to the success of our economy. Community colleges are the place where many of our low-income students and students of color start. Community colleges are the place where many of our working adults go to get additional skills. They're often the gateway to higher education. If you think about Micron coming to Central New York, Onondaga Community College is going to be key to the success of that enterprise.
Do they know that?
They do, and you know, when it was announced that Micron was coming to the region, they did the announcement at Onondaga Community College. It's important to the state's future that our community colleges prepare the semiconductor workforce we need, the healthcare workforce that we need, as we try to take climate action and move away from fossil fuels towards renewable energy. Community colleges, like Hudson Valley, are going to be at the center of that effort. So we have to invest in our community colleges. You know, community colleges in New York are a partnership between the state and the county. We have a need to put more resources into faculty in particular at our community colleges. We have many folks who are adjuncts. We need to work to make sure we have more full-time faculty. We need to make sure that our community colleges have wraparound supports for students, childcare, help with transportation, the things that will help students, again, not just start, but finish.
You just mentioned something that I've thought about for a long time as a longtime professor myself, the status of the adjunct. Self-respect is so important in whatever we do. And I just want to ask you whether or not you and your colleagues are doing everything in your power to make sure that people know how valued they are when they are adjunct.
Yes. We're trying to send that message at the SUNY system. But look, we have to make sure that folks who are teaching as adjuncts, if they want to be full-time faculty, see a path to doing that.
Like what?
Well, look, you know, there are many folks who are choosing an adjunct path because they haven't been able to find that permanent faculty position. Last year, the state put $53 million into new permanent faculty positions and committed to keep investing that $53 million over the next few years. That's vital because as we grow a quality faculty, we can grow opportunity for students.
Do students have the proper amount of respect for what they're getting in higher education in New York?
I think they do, but I think there's still sort of a best-kept secret aspect to public higher education in New York. You know, many students maybe know about Binghamton or they know about Stony Brook, but they don't know that at SUNY Purchase, we have an incredible acting program that's produced superstars,
yeah,
right?
True.
Or they may not know, they're really passionate about music, they may not know that we have an amazing music school at SUNY Potsdam. So there's work that we need to do to make sure our students know the full range of offerings across SUNY.
Well, you're the head man, so how does it go when you have to appoint a head of one of these subordinate institutions? I had a friend named Tom Schwartz who was the head at one point at Purchase. So what do you do? Do you sit there and hold your head and say, how am I going to find the right people?
You know, we recruit nationally. We try to get the best people to come to lead our campuses. We have a very inclusive process that allows faculty and the school community to get to know the finalists. Then the finalists spend time with our leadership team at SUNY Central. I spend time with the finalists. And then I recommend.
What happens when you find one? Yeah. I'm sorry for interrupting, but what happens when you find one and they say, I don't like this?
We can go back to the search committee and say, we've got to start over.
Have you done it? Have you done it? Yes.
That has happened in the past. But, you know, we hope that the search will produce at least one and sometimes multiple quality candidates that we can then present to the SUNY Board of Trustees for consideration.
This must be very hard on you personally to have to cull out the ones that will make it and will not.
Look, you know, it's part of our responsibility to make sure we're doing everything we can to serve students as well as possible. You know, when I was U.S. Secretary of Education, I would talk about the important role that public higher education plays, not just in our national economy, but in our democracy. And you know this, having taught at Albany. We are preparing the citizens, the leaders, the folks who are going to solve our biggest problems as a society. That's our mission. And so we've got to make sure that every campus is led by someone who can deliver on that mission.
How did you get your job?
Let me start here that sure. How I got into education.
Yes.
And, you know, this is something I think you and I have talked about in the past. It's really because of the role school played in my own life. Both my parents were New York City public school educators. They both passed away when I was a kid. My mom when I was 8, my dad when I was 12. The only reason I'm sitting here today is because of the role that New York City public school teachers played in my life. School was the one place that was safe and supportive. After my mom passed, my father was struggling with Alzheimer's. Home was scary and unstable.
I'm sorry.
Thank you. But teachers made school this place where I could be a kid when I couldn't be a kid at home. So that's what drove me to become an educator. I had the privilege to be a high school teacher, a middle school principal, to lead school systems, to come to Albany the last time to serve as state commissioner, where you're responsible for overseeing K-12, higher ed, museums and libraries, the licensing of professions, and then went to Washington to work for President Obama, first as deputy secretary and then as secretary of education, which is an incredible experience. And, you know, people forget that the secretary of education oversees K-12, but also there's an immense amount of work that's focused on higher education. The U.S. Education Department is overseeing the accreditors who approve all of our higher ed institutions. They're overseeing our financial aid system as a country. So spent a lot of time on higher ed issues as secretary, and then have been running a civil rights organization where we work on equity issues in higher education. And so the opportunity to come to SUNY was really a continuation of a lifelong commitment to education as an engine of opportunity and equity.
We are talking to John King, the 15th chancellor of the State University of New York, the largest comprehensive system of public higher education in the United States. Hey, look, you're a very important man. Does it ever go to your head?
My wife and my daughters always keep me humble. So
how do they do that?
Well, in part reminding me of the joy of simple things and making fun of me for corny dad jokes.
Oh, corny dad jokes. I know about those. Yeah. Now, tell us a little bit about your relationship with Barack Obama. You know, he's a hero to so many of us. Did you get any quality time with him? Did you get to talk to him? Can you give us an assessment of what was going on there?
Yeah. We spent a lot of time together. President Obama and Mrs. Obama both care very deeply about education and the role that it can play in a person's life. You know, Mrs. Obama was a first-generation college student. You know, President Obama will talk about, you know, how education helped broaden his perspective over his life. So they were both very committed to education issues. The president really was very invested in how we expand educational opportunity in the country, very concerned about low-income students, students of color, rural students, not getting the same opportunities as their more affluent peers. And so we spent a lot of time working on those kinds of equity issues. When I was deputy and then as secretary, I also worked on something called My Brother's Keeper, which was the president's initiative to expand opportunity, particularly for boys and young men of color. And some of the work that we did in that area was some of the most meaningful work. I think about spending time with the president, with some of the young men who were in our White House mentoring program. And his personal investment in helping young people make good choices and in expanding the circle of opportunity. One of the things we worked on through My Brother's Keeper was restoring access to Pell Grants for folks who are incarcerated. Because the president believed, rightly, that folks who've made a mistake in their lives, who are incarcerated, need a path to get their lives on track. And higher education can be that. And I will tell you, when you visit prison higher education programs, it's incredibly moving. Because for many folks, it's the first time that they see themselves taken seriously as a student. It's an opportunity for them to not only improve the quality of their life when they get out with a better job and more economic opportunity, but often to improve their relationship with their family, to improve how they see themselves. So those kinds of equity-focused initiatives were a huge priority for the president. It was a pleasure to work with him on those.
I'll bet that when you walked into a room and there was the president of the United States, it had to affect you somehow, right?
Yeah, of course. I mean, you're very conscious of what an honor it is to serve in the administration, to serve the country. President Obama is incredibly smart and thoughtful and took the job so seriously and, you know, read every word of every memo, came into meetings prepared with rigorous questions. And you think about, you know, he'd leave the meeting with me and go into a meeting with Susan Rice on some international crisis. And he would be as laser focused in every meeting on whatever issue was in front of us. And always asking, you know, what's the right thing to do here? And that was the question that drove our policy conversations, trying to figure out the right thing.
Did you ever get mad at him?
No. Actually, but such a blessing to work for someone where you know you are every day inspired. I I did get mad at Congress at times for the unwillingness to move forward on issues.
Tell them all.
No, but I definitely made clear my frustration that we couldn't tackle some of the tough issues. You know, the president would say the hardest day of his time in office was the day of Sandy Hook.
Of course.
And the fact that you could have babies, right, those children slaughtered in their classroom and their teachers, and then Congress not do anything, just incredibly frustrating. And, you know, as the person responsible for education in the country, to see the unwillingness of Congress to act on keeping our kids safe, incredibly frustrating.
Well, let me ask you this, John King. Did you ever talk to any of them about that?
Yes. And, you know, I think we're at a place in our culture where the culture around guns sort of keeps people from even considering reasonable limitations that we should all be able to agree on. You know, now in New York, we've made more progress in other states, but we're one country. And so if you're able to get a weapon of war in one state, you can easily carry it over into another state.
Certainly, we know that in New York, it's coming over those borders all the time.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. You know, another issue where we couldn't get action, you know, look, immigration is a complicated issue. But I think everyone would agree that kids who've grown up their whole lives here, who only know the United States, who are succeeding in school, should have the opportunity to stay in the country, to get higher education, to get a good job. The dreamers, as those students are called, we should all be able to agree that we should make opportunity available for them, and that that's true to who we are as Americans. And again, just couldn't get Congress to move. Still, to this day, Congress has not taken action on the kind of immigration reform we need to protect the dreamers. And so those things were very frustrating, and you know, they were frustrating to the president, they were frustrating to our entire team.
Well, it's clear, it should be clear to anybody who's listening, that you are a brilliant man. My question is, you also are a man of color. So the question is, do people of color in this country get a proper chance to achieve the highest offices, one of which you have?
Not yet. You know, racism is real, still part of our everyday in the United States. You know, one of the things that I've learned in my family history over the last few years, we always knew there was a connection to the institution of slavery, but actually I've learned of the exact property where my great-grandfather was enslaved. It is still owned to this day by the family that are descendants of the family that enslaved my family. The cabin that my great-grandfather lived in as an enslaved person, still standing on the property.
Wow.
And so I've been able to stand inside of that cabin with my wife and my daughters. And, you know, when I do, I'm very conscious of the fact that history is not that long ago, that the institution of slavery was incredibly cruel. I mean, these were two families living in the same physical space, one owning the other. The cabin's not 30 feet from the main house.
And you said incredibly cruel, right?
Incredibly cruel. Yeah. A horrible institution, and its legacy has been with us. You think about the fact that we didn't really vindicate the right of African Americans to vote until the Voting Rights Act of 1965, and we're still struggling over that issue, right? So that history is still with us. I am also conscious, when I stand inside of that cabin, of the fact that in my family, we went in three generations from enslaved in that cabin to serving in the cabinet of the first black president. So progress is possible. But we have a lot more progress to make.
That was an incredible statement. I wasn't absolutely ready for it, but about serving in the cabinet. You have family, you have friends. When you're a doctor, when you're the only doctor in the family, everybody comes to you because you're a physician. Do all kinds of people come to you personally because of your position?
Yeah, I think, you know, because I have spent my life in these different very visible roles in education, people often come to talk about their worries about their kids. You know, I'll say during COVID, whether it was parents of K-12 students or parents of college students, it was really hard. People found it really hard. They're seeing their kids isolated from peers. We certainly experienced this as parents. It's incredibly difficult. You know, part of the joy of childhood is your relationships with friends, extracurricular activities, theater, sports. Kids lost all of that. For college students, instead of being on campus learning, they were in their rooms on a computer.
I only want to spend a few seconds, because that's all we have, about the question of student debt and how we're doing. That's a question.
Yeah. Well, look, in 1980, the Pell Grant program covered 80% of the cost of public higher education, the federal Pell Grant program.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
Today, less than 30%, right? So what's happened over the last 40 years, really since the Reagan administration, is as a country, we've transitioned the cost from a public good to putting it all on students and families. And so we have trillions of dollars of debt. For many students, it is preventing them from buying a house, from starting a business, from starting a family. So I'm glad that President Biden is leading on this, trying to cancel student debt. And I'm glad that at SUNY, we have kept public higher education affordable. SUNY is among the most affordable public higher education options in the country, and we're going to keep it that way.
Well, it's an amazing story. I'm very proud to have been able to have worked in SUNY all of my life, and I know what a terrific institution it is. And frankly, I know what a terrific guy you are in leading it right now. So we're out of time. Our guest has been SUNY Chancellor John King. John, as always, thanks so much for joining us. I hope you'll be back real soon.
Thank you so much.
Capital Connection is a production of WAMC Northeast Public Radio. For copies, call 1-800-323-9262 or visit us online anytime at WAMC.org, or just schedule a podcast anywhere you get your podcasts. And join us again next week at this same time for another political conversation. Thanks for listening.